Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 16.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 16. You were talking about the Durham connection with the American aircraft, Colonel.
Yes. George Sweeting from the well-known Cornforth butchering family was pilot of this Vultee Vengeance dive bomber, and his job was to drop supplies to our guerrilla groups of Force 136 and Z Force in the jungles to the east, which were Japanese held, but where, as I mentioned earlier, Karen guerrillas with British officers operated and were a very active thorn in the flesh of the Japanese. George Sweeting very kindly gave me a flight in his Vultee Vengeance round the Irrawaddy Delta, and it was very interesting for me to see how the round Japanese foxholes stood out clearly from the air. Their bunkers, of course, and defensive positions were, of course, roofed and well covered. We found them difficult to spot in the advance because of them being flush with the ground, but from the air they were very, very visible. And, of course, in central Burma, our Hurricane bombers with bombing and machine gun and cannon close support invaluable, such as in the Irrawaddy bridgehead. We flew around Cirium and the Delta area for a good 45 minutes, had a good look at the countryside, and on returning were given a red because there was a scramble of a fighter flight, obviously suspecting some enemy intrusion. We landed and the scramble was precautionary, and the fighter flight, which had scrambled, didn't actually make contact with any Japanese aircraft. Sadly, about this time, on the RAF side, our intelligence officer, Lieutenant Jack Birkmar, was out with a patrol near the Mingledon airfield, and they paused to watch a Dakota aircraft coming into land. For some inexplicable reason, the Dakota didn't make the runway and suddenly dropped into the overshoot and blew up. We learnt later that in addition to the four-man crew of the Dakota, there had been 23 pilots as passengers in that aircraft due to join respective squadrons at Mingledon. So there was 27 good men and true gone woomph at one fell swoop. On the 24th of July, I was summoned to the adjutant's office and told that I and three soldiers were to proceed to a transit camp in Rangoon to go on UK leave on LIAP 12. This was the 12th party to go on leave in advance of Python. One of the soldiers with me was Corporal Wilde, from my hometown of Sunderland. We went to the transit camp that day, stayed the night there in this building which had been commandeered. At this time, the streets of Rangoon were very untidy, had run down badly during the Japanese occupation. The Japanese occupation money, or banana money as it was known as in Burma and later in Malaya, littered the streets, and it had lost all its pre-war status as in the days of the British Raj. The following day, we went aboard the troop ship HMS Her Majesty's Transport Devonshire and commenced the 3-day trip to Calcutta. So it was quite a peaceful and relaxing atmosphere. Other chaps were going on leave, and it was great to chat and compare experiences. Having reached Calcutta, I stayed through there and spent a night or two nights in transit at the Grand Hotel. I met one of the Hurricane fighter pilots there, Squadron Leader Bob Stout. And again, it was interesting to compare notes, and whilst impossible to say which had been his aircraft, he was part of the group that had given us close support in central Burma. We made the 3-day train journey from Calcutta to Pune, which is not far from Bombay, and were in transit at Pune. There we met up with RAF people also going on leave, and we spent a few days playing football and generally relaxing after what had been quite a taxing time. Whilst at Pune, we heard the astounding news that an atomic bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and had literally taken out this garrison town on the Japanese mainland. We knew that the United States Air Force had commenced day round-the-clock bombing of the Japanese mainland from the captured island bases in Okinawa and Iwo Jima, and that the conventional bombing alone was devastating the main Japanese cities, Tokyo included.
What was your response, immediate response, when you heard this news?
Quite amazed. Totally out of the blue. I personally didn't comprehend what an atomic bomb was, but we knew deep down that it would have a profound effect on the war against Japan. We weren't sufficiently overconfident to think that it might bring the war to a conclusion. We then flew from Pune to Karachi, plane load of 23 of us. They had some trouble getting the aircraft going, and after 2 or 3 false starts, we eventually took off one afternoon for Karachi. Halfway through the flight over the sea, the second pilot came back and asked us to put our seat belts on. In the Dakota, you sat either side alongside the windows facing each other. We put our seat belts on and proceeded on our way, and eventually touched down at Moripaur, the airfield of Karachi. When we got there, the second pilot laughingly told us that the reason why he told us to put the seat straps on, waist belt, the fact that both engines had cut out momentarily. We were quite pleased to be on the ground. Whilst we're in transit at Moripaur, the American Air Force dropped a second atomic bomb on Japan at Nagasaki. We were again quite amazed at this, and the press comment was that it was a distinct possibility that Japanese might now surrender. We took off from Karachi on the afternoon of the 14th of August 1945 and flew slightly out to sea along the Baluchistan coast. Then we entered the Arabian Gulf, the Persian Gulf as it is then known, at the Straits of Hormuz. I looked down on the land on the south side of the Gulf and said to myself how accurate it had been portrayed in the Phillips Atlas at school. I wasn't to know that many years later, in fact October 1973, and then again from January to May 1974, I would actually be in command of that Masandam Peninsula, part of Oman. We pressed on up the Persian Gulf and landed at Bahrain in the early evening. After spam, bacon and eggs, we got aboard the plane again, and there was no news. Darkness had fallen shortly after entering the Gulf, and we took off again in darkness from Bahrain. Shortly after midnight, having flown up the Gulf past Basra, we landed at Habaneh in Iraq, a pre-war RAF station and built in the colonial style. We landed at Hab shortly after midnight, and on deplaning, we're told by the chaps manning the steps and the refueling aircraft that the Japanese had surrendered. We couldn't believe it. We went for, again, the old ham, spam, bacon and egg stunt, got on aboard the plane again, and set off for Lydda in Palestine. We chatted about it in the plane, and I was chatting to Lieutenant Brookhouse from our 6th Brigade engineers and others, and we couldn't believe, having seen the Japs fight to the death in Burma, that they would ignore the Emperor's call to surrender. And we were quite convinced that they would fight on in the other parts of Southeast Asia, which they still occupied, and that it could still be a costly business. In fact, would still be a costly business. Time, however, was to prove us wrong. As dawn broke, we could see the line of the pipeline from Iraq to Haifa in Palestine, and then daylight was just breaking as we flew over Lake Galilee. And down below we could see the red roofs of Tiberias and orange groves in the Holy Land. We landed at Lydda, and there again it was confirmed that the Japs had surrendered and the war was over. We went into a very smart transit camp with stone and concrete buildings, very clean and tidy, maintained so by Italian prisoners of war who had been employed on domestic duties rather than operating from a prisoner of war camp. And we fed well on the fruit and good food of Palestine. We were 5 days in transit there, and one afternoon we were given the opportunity of either going to Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. I chose Tel Aviv for a swim in the Med. I felt that Jerusalem would be commercialised, and whilst not a very religious person, I felt that I'd been close enough to my Maker in the previous months without going to see anything connected with the Muslim, Jewish or Christian faith commercialised in Jerusalem or anywhere else. After 5 days in transit, we boarded another Dakota and took off again for El Adam in the Western Desert. We proceeded there without incident, again had a light meal and took off. And on this occasion, the crew very kindly kept us not at the statutory 10,000 feet flight level, but much lower down, so we could get a view of parts of the Western Desert where there had been fierce fighting, and one could easily pick out wrecked aircraft, tanks and vehicles, and empty positions on the ground. We flew out over Benghazi and headed for El Mas, which was the airfield at Cagliari in Sardinia. We landed at El Mas in the evening, but before we were due to leave in the late evening, we were told that we were staying the night there in transit because of an electric storm. We weren't due to take off till late morning, so I took the opportunity to have a look round the hangars and got inside and had a look round one of the Italian three-engined Savoia seaplanes. We then took off from east, from El Mas, planning to do the last leg of the 39-hour, 55-minute scheduled flight, although it had taken much longer, including the 5 days in transit. The actual flight time from Pune to Merrifield and Somerset was scheduled at 39 hours, 55 minutes, but on going up the Rhone Valley, having passed over Marseille, we entered a very violent storm up the Rhone Valley and were bucking around rather like a roller coaster. Unfortunately, the pilot, Warrant Officer Bill Sykes at that stage, hadn't ordered us to strap in, and suddenly we hit a cumulus nimbus cloud and came down as if we were in a lift. All 23 of us shot up and hit the roof, and I went up to the roof, and I can even see it now as if it was this morning, an Indian Army officer reading his penguin book, and he's still reading it on the way up. We hit the roof and then all fell on the floor in a heap. The aircraft lurched over onto its port wing. I flung up against the window and I looked out and saw the ground, the aircraft having come clean out of the clouds. I said to myself, "F it, we've had the effer. France, of all the effing places to be buried in." Warrant Officer Sykes right at the aircraft, and we got back into our seats either side of the aircraft, which was one continuous aluminium and canvas seat, strapped ourselves in. Lieutenant Brookhouse opposite me had a split head, and another chap further up the aircraft was bleeding from the head. Another chap opposite me and to the right had crawled towards the toilet at the rear of the aircraft, and I said, "Strap yourself in, what do you want to go in there for?" And quite fearful, the poor chap replied, telling the truth, I want to die by myself, sir." We then went back up into the storm and bucked around for a while, and one of the crew told us we were trying to divert to Bordeaux. However, the storm was so bad, Warrant Officer Sykes did a 180-degree turn and came out of it. We then made an unscheduled landing at an airfield near Marseille, a French Air Force base, East, Istres. There, the two chaps with split heads and two others went to the medical centre for stitching and treatment. We were put in transit in buildings on the airfield itself and given a good meal. The room we were in, a grenade had been thrown into it, and you could see where it had gone off on the floor during the fighting when the Americans liberated southern France in Operation Dragoon. The following day, we took off again in our Dakota for Merrifield, and a Royal Army Service Corps officer sitting between myself and a pilot next to the door, an RAF pilot, who was also in transit, was so nervous that they had to let him go up front and travel with the crew. Bill Sykes very kindly let the aircraft down over the channel, and we saw landing craft flying to within the channel, and then we saw England loom up over Portland Bill. He then came in quite low over Somerset on the approach to Merrifield Airfield, which is near Ilminster in Somerset, and I can assure you the green fields of Somerset and the farmland looked like heaven. We landed, went through customs, were given rail warrants, and proceeded by train to the transit camp, London District Assembly Centre in London.
What day did you land, Colonel?
It would be about the 21st, 22nd of August, because we heard of the Japanese surrender at Habonier for the 14th, and then 5 days in Palestine, a night at El Mas, a night in East Marseille. It would be around about the 21st, 22nd of August 1945. The train journey again, Somerset, Wiltshire, Hampshire, Berkshire to Paddington, was absolutely marvellous. England at its best at the end of August. I reported in at the London District Assembly Centre, the Hotel Great Central Marylebone, from which I had left 2 years previously as an officer cadet. On this occasion, I was an officer and had a bed with sheets and pillows. Had a meal straight off to bed. There was a party going on, which I couldn't be bothered to attend. I wanted a good night's sleep, get the train from King's Cross the next day.
Could you sleep and relax after the ride?
I slept like a log. got on the train. It was like a Chinese refugee train. I had a first-class warrant, but that didn't mean a damn. I stood in a corridor with an American serviceman who was going up to Scotland on leave. And I said, well, there's one thing I'll show you. The finest view in Europe, Durham Cathedral and Castle from the railway line, which Ruskin described as the eighth wonder of the world. It was lovely to see the countryside and other airfields on the way north, Peterborough area and Lincolnshire. And we passed through Durham. I pointed out to my American colleague the cathedral and castle, and then I got off the train and bade him farewell at Newcastle. I then got the stopping train to Sunderland. I was wearing exactly what I'd left the battalion in at Mingla Don, Rangoon, my bush hat, the DLI badge on the front, my jungle green jacket, trousers. I carried a Japanese pack, a Luger automatic pistol, and a bit of kit in a case. I got off the train at the station, Union Street in Sunderland, and I saw a bus either at Durham or Harrington Burn, I hope they spring on it. There was a queue, and I said to the inspector, does this one stop at the Board Inn? He said, yes, get in, and pushed me straight into the bus. It dropped me off at the farm gate, and I walked up the drive and round the corner. There was my mother crossing the yard. She was overwhelmed to see me, and I was very, very pleased and proud to see her. There was no emotions. We were just heartily thankful. I went in. My sister Mary was very, very pleased again and relieved to see me, as was my elder brother Ernest. My brother Wesley was slightly moved by it, but for once, we were not the highly charged emotional family we were. I was alive. Too many people had paid the supreme price.
They had no idea that you were coming?
None whatsoever. Because of uncertainty of train times and movements, I deemed it unwise to telephone or send a telegram or anything like that. I just wanted to get home with minimum fuss. And one of my immediate aims, and which I carried out, was to notify other people by telephone or letter exactly how their sons and fathers were faring, and in still alive, the war having ended several days previously.
How did your friends and acquaintances receive you?
Very pleased to see me back alive, but I hadn't got a lot of friends and acquaintances at that time, because like me, they're all away doing this stuff, and they were either in the Middle East or the Far East or in Europe.
Were you bombarded by questions? And
No. People knew what had gone on through the press. The British press was very reliable, over-exaggerated on occasions, but people were too relieved that the war was over. Besides which, I'm not a great believer in a lot of hoo-ha. I made a point at the end of my leave of spending 3 days in London and going to visit Colonel Fillingham of the 70th Battalion, who commanded the 70th Battalion, the DLI, who I'd had a very super letter from in Rangoon, and Colonel Tim Beatt of the DLI at the War Office. My connection with Colonel Fillingham, which I really valued, arose through the fact that some of my soldiers, McCall or Pearson or Sergeant Rushford, had written to him and said that their platoon commander was a Lieutenant Waitman from the well-known County Durham farming family. And right out of the blue, Philly, as he was affectionately known as in the Durhams, wrote me a letter congratulating me on being commissioned in the county regiment. He, in fact, commanded C Company, and when his MC with it in 2DLI in World War One. He said a lot of other complimentary things, which is obviously gleaned from the likes of Pearson McCaw, Sergeant Rushford, and others of the 70th Battalion DLI, which are commanded at Barnet Castle. I paid a visit to Durham Cathedral, a building very, very dear to me, and to the regimental chapel therein. There I noticed a memorial scroll commemorating those young soldiers of the 70th Battalion Durham Light Infantry who had served as Durham Light Infantrymen, commandos and parachutists. When I met Colonel Fillingham at the end of my leave at Luton Hoo, the home of Sir Harold and Lady Verner, which was an army resettlement college, at that time called a formation college, he told me he had put it there in direct defiance of the colonel of the regiment. And he was that sort of chap. His soldiers were immortal to him, and he to them. Very proud to have met him and known him. On that visit, we were going down the stately staircase of Luton Hoo, in one of the actual stairs, there was a chunk of concrete missing, or marble, or whatever it was, and Philly pointed to it and said, "Look at that! Someone's taken a bite out of that step. God," he said, "he must have been bloody hungry." I there met a chap who I'd known at school, much senior to me, Wally Greenwood, who'd been injured as a sapper officer in the war, knocked about a bit. It was good to see him back and safe in one piece, albeit knocked about a bit. It was whilst walking along a corridor to Philly's office that I first had an inkling, although I didn't attach much importance to it, that my ears might have been affected, because the chap, the officer, leading me along the corridor, okay, our heavy shoes, our heavy Lotus Veltschard shoes, were banging on the corridor, and he turned to me before we went into Philly's office and said, "Were you deafened in the war?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, I've been talking to you. You haven't heard a word." It was possible a legacy of when I was blown off my feet on Sandy Ridge on the 27th of February, 1945, in the Irrawaddy Bridgehead. On my visit to Durham Cathedral, I had the pleasure of the friendship of a friend from Sutherland, Miss Muriel Mayling, who was a descendant of the famous Sutherland General Sir Henry Havelock. And we visited the regimental chapel, and on the way back in the bus, I noticed a cloud of smoke over the farm at Middle Harrington, and on going there we found that a stupid child with a box of matches had set fire to the stackyard, which was full of the 1945 harvest gathered in, and every stack was burnt to ashes. This was a very bad blow to the staff who carried on under my mother's command and direction after father's death a few months previously. Miss Mayling was a friend from school days, and remained a friend in passing until her sad death 2 years ago. On my trip to London, her mother met me in at King's Cross Station, and I saw her safely off on the train back up north. While staying in London, I was actually at the Park Lane Hotel, and in the middle of September, a flypast took place, being the first Battle of Britain flypast, so I would reckon it was the 15th of September 1945. The chambermaid was dusting the room, and I was sitting quietly when suddenly there was a terrific swoosh across the west end of London. I immediately reacted as if it was a shell, and I shouted, "Get down!" I suddenly realised, hearing the sound of aircraft, that it must have been an aircraft, and I apologised to the chambermaid, saying, "I'm frightfully sorry, I thought that was a shell." She immediately said, "Don't worry, sir, We had it here as well, with the buzz bombs. In fact, it was one of the early de Havilland jets piloted by Geoffrey de Havilland himself, taking part in the Battle of Britain 5 past 1945. Privileged with others to have this month's leave, which I found relaxing, but nevertheless, most of my thoughts were still beyond the Chinwin.